Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Seconds. Where are seconds? Seconds might be all around you, even now. Rock Hudson, in an astonishing change of pace, stars in Seconds. Rock Hudson, as a man who buys for himself a totally new life, a chance to begin again. Every man's dream since time began.
Staring at me like that. Hey, John. Hey, John.
Why are they staring at me like that?
They're like you.
Reborn.
Oh, Laura!
The John Frankenheimer film, Seconds. Bold. Bizarre. Terrifying. Seconds.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and joining me is co-host, Mr. Mike White.
I'll have my seconds call your seconds.
And we're joined this week by, I guess he's one of the gentlemen of the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Samurai.
Yeah, I could have swore that train ticket said Scarsdale.
Very nice. This week, we're talking about the 1966 film Seconds, based on the novel by David Ely. Seconds is the final piece of what some call John Frankenheimer's paranoia trilogy. Tells the tale of Arthur Hamilton, a successful New York banker, husband, and father, who seems to have played by all the rules of corporate America, but just doesn't seem happy with his life. Soon a dead friend starts calling him on the phone, gives him some mysterious instructions to a place, and a secret group that can give Arthur a new lease on life by faking his death, a little plastic surgery, and a whole new identity as an artist, Tony Wilson. In Malibu, California. But as soon as Arthur agrees to the change, he finds out that his whole new life may not be the reality he hoped for or the second chance he really wanted, and there could be a heavy price to pay for that new body. Of course, that just scratches the surface. And speaking of, we're going to be talking some spoilers on this one. So if you haven't seen Seconds, I really advise that if you want to know where all the twists and turns are going to be, just turn the podcast off now, go watch the film, and then come back. Don't worry, we'll be waiting for you. So, Samurai, you are our guest. What's your history with Seconds?
So I have a little bit of an interesting history with Seconds. When the news broke that Rock Hudson had AIDS and he was, made a public appearance and he was very feeble. He looked really rough. My mother said, he was never really a great actor, but he had a great face. Now, my mom is really the person that generates all my love of film, really, because she was always the one that would say things like that. You're like, yeah, he had a great face. Wasn't so great of an actor, but he had a great face or a great, move or something like that. So I was like, well, what's his best film? Hey, Mom, what's his best film in your opinion? She said, well, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I think it's a movie called Minutes. And that's a true story, actually. So I started doing a little research. This is before the internet and all that good stuff. And I come to find out it's possibly this film called Seconds. And I was a fan of Frankenheimer's previous stuff, Birdman, and which my grandfather loved. And, of course, Manchurian, 7 Days in May, or whatever it is. I think it's 7 Days in May. I think it's what it is. Yeah, I'm not as big a fan of that one. But so I go to the video store. This was a place called Red Giraffe Video. I don't know if they had these in Michigan. Probably not. And I found this VHS and I watched this film and I was kind of blown away that I had never heard of it. I was about 16 at the time. I was kind of really just blown away that nobody ever talked about it. And come to find out, for many years after that, nobody still talked about this film. And I really think it's one of the best films about paranoia that I think has ever been made. Possibly maybe the best, in my opinion. It was wonderful, and like every time somebody would say, hey, let's go see Total Recall again. Now, I love Total Recall, and I love it for what it is, and it's a science fiction movie, and it's a slightly different tale. But at the same time, it kind of has that, that genesis of the bored suburban gentleman who wants to, put some zest in his life. And I would always recommend Seconds with Rock Hudson. And at the time, unfortunately, I would get a lot of bad looks, less similar to the bad Rock Hudson jokes that used to go around. So It was one of these films that I used to champion a lot, and we've actually tried to cover it on our podcast, but we just never have gotten to it. So when I saw this was on the list, I was like, yeah, Mike, you know, you got to let me come on and talk about Seconds.
What about you, Mr. Mike?
I actually saw this one way back in the day. You guys probably remember when AMC wasn't the kind of commercial-ridden trash that it is now, with the exception of its original programming. But back when it actually showed movies, it was kind of like the pre-TCM, and they just would show films all the way through, and they would have little, you know, Buster Keaton film festivals and all this. And they showed Seconds, God, it was probably 96, 97, and made kind of a big deal about it because, you know, here was this film that nobody really talked about, kind of what the samurai was saying. And sure enough, you know, nobody still talked about it afterwards, but luckily I was able to VHS tape a copy of it off of the airwaves and watch it. And it really impressed me visually. The story didn't really capture my imagination as much as it probably should have, but visually it was really striking, and I really liked what Frankenheimer was doing with the camera and using the camera to kind of enhance what the story was. So I found it very pleasing visually.
And I think a lot of that has to go down to James Wong Howe. I mean, James Wong Howe was an amazing cinematographer. And here, I mean, when you think about it, it's 1966. Pretty much everything had been in color for about the last 10 years. And for you to come along and go, you know, we're going to make this movie and we're going to do it in black and white by that late in the 60s is kind of a radical departure.
Agreed. It is a very aggressive style of filmmaking, right? I mean, it's... And what Mike said, it captures you immediately. The story might not capture you the first time. As a matter of fact, it's not even really that complicated of a story. Once you really know the basic plot of it, it's really pretty simple. But the way Frankenheimer and Howe shot it, the fisheye lenses, all this kind of thing, it just really, it's almost like a drug trip or like, you know, some type of psychedelic thing without all the color, you know?
Yeah, from that opening, that Saul Bass opening title sequence where faces are just so distorted and those close-ups on the lips and going, you know, into the nose and everything. It just, that really sets the tone along with that Jerry Goldsmith score of you're in for something that's going to kind of play with your mind.
Like you said, I mean, I don't think we need to belabor the plot because I think that I pretty much handled it in the opening of what the plot is. It's more about how the characters interplay. It's more about how the Arthur Hamilton character and then the Tony Wilson character deal with pre and post being a second, and then also the corporation and things like that. I do agree with you. It really leans a lot on the visuals, and the visuals are quite amazing. And also, like I said, when you think about it, you have James Wong Howe as the cinematographer, but he's not listed in the credits. But listening to the commentary track, John Alonzo was the second camera operator on this film, and he went on to win an Oscar for Chinatown and shot other big films such as Scarface and things like that. But the one thing that I thought was kind of revolutionary, and was really the first time that I saw it in Seconds, although I think I saw Requiem for a Dream and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels first, and then I saw Seconds after, is this sort of attaching the camera to the character and having them walk through the space. And it puts them directly in focus, and also everything is through their perception. So the one that I saw it in Seconds, although I think I saw Requiem for a Dream, like odd POV shots and things like that that are in this that really kind of throw you off kilter. And it's really, I think, a great way to bring across the psychological state of the characters.
Yeah, I remember when the Wachowskis, when Bound came out and they hooked that camera up to Joey Pants and he was moving around. I was just like, so fascinated by it, and I immediately had like a Seconds flashback.
Yeah, of course. You guys are using like all these really like highfalutin examples, and I'm like, well, at the end of Truck Turner, Yaphet Kotto has the same kind of thing going on. The Snorri cam, yeah.
That might be the highest example, in my opinion.
Well, you looked this up and you put this in the notes, and I didn't realize it went as far back as it did.
Yeah, it was from these two Icelandic directors, Einar and Eor Snorri, who actually, though they have the same last name, are not related, and so they call it the Snorri cam, S-N-O-R-R-I-C-A-M, and yeah, it's been, the people have been using it for a long time, and so it's such an unusual thing that I think that's why it kind of sticks out for all of us when we can kind of think back to these examples. I think the other one that really comes to my mind is Mean Streets. I seem to remember there was, if it wasn't David Carradine, it was Harvey Keitel, but I think it might have been Carradine where he was playing a drunk, and it kind of gives you that whole, the world's out of joint, but you're perfectly in focus kind of thing.
We did talk a little bit about the opening with Saul Bass, and it's just nice to see his stuff because, I mean, if you're not familiar with Saul Bass, you know his visuals, be it the opening of Psycho, be it the opening of Vertigo, the Otto Preminger films, North by Northwest, things like that, his poster designs, things like that. I mean, just an amazing designer. I mean, the guy just basically would come in and do credit sequences. He did the opening to Spartacus. I think his last one was Casino before he died. Martin Scorsese brought him in for that. And just that opening, as you were saying, Mike, just really brings you in. And then also with that, not only talking about the visuals, but this score from Jerry Goldsmith is just so odd. Just the first track, I mean, the first thing you hear is this, it's kind of like odd sci-fi music. There's like a fiddle in it. There's an organ. There's electronics in it. I mean, it's really like this layered piece that just kind of creeps you out just listening to it.
Yeah, one of these days we're going to have to cover Phase 4, which was the only feature that Saul Bass directed. He also did some short films, too, that are kind of out there. Phase 4 is relatively straight ahead, though there's some interesting macro photography. It's the whole story of like these ants that take over the world after we pass the tail of a comet kind of thing. And it's one of my favorite animals taking over the Earth kind of movie. And so we should definitely take a look at that one. And then, yeah, Goldsmith, he's always been a favorite of mine ever since I first heard Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I can say that I'm not usually the biggest Goldsmith guy, but I do really appreciate this score quite a bit because it really sets the tone for the film. Between that and the photography, immediately you should pretty much know what you're in for. And then the choices Frankenheimer makes, like not even having Rock Hudson in the film. This is Rock Hudson. This is 1966. I don't know how big he was in 66, but I know he was pretty big years previous to that. And, you know, to have the gall, really, to not have him show up except in a drawing about 36 minutes into the film is really just, you know, the whole film just kind of throws you off a little bit. And I think that's why it works so well for me, because I've seen it now a handful of times, at least 5 times, I would say. And still, every time I watch it, I rewatch it just for doing the show here. And it still throws me off just a little bit. It's almost like I find a little nugget in there every time. I'm like, why would he choose to do that? As opposed to the teenage me, which was just pausing the VHS tape to try to find nudity.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Rock Hudson is that all these critics notice this. If you go back and read the original reviews on Seconds when it came out, they like laughed at it and thought it was ridiculous that this sort of frumpy, you know, banker from New York played by John Randolph, who's, you know, great in his role, would of course get turned into Rock Hudson. I guess maybe the equivalent today would be, you know, being turned into Brad Pitt or something, or the guy who was in Twilight. You know, it's like, oh, it's just so ridiculous. And of course they're going to turn you into like this hunky guy that all the ladies are going to swoon for. But the thing that's interesting to me is now, you know, 40 plus years on, I don't have that kind of reaction to it, because I guess maybe Rock Hudson, I don't think of him as this, you know, strapping handsome dude, you know. he's not in my pop culture milieu like if it was, I guess, Brad Pitt, then maybe I would laugh at it. But the critics at the time thought it was terrible. They thought it was a horrible choice.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. I mean, Rock Hudson was a matinee idol, you know. I would guess that, you know, not being around to experience that at the time when he was this huge movie star, I guess that, you know, people would react that way, because you sometimes get film fans who react to the pretty boy actor that way, regardless of the film, regardless of their talent. Some people just don't like to look at people that are attractive. I call it jealousy, or call it insanity. I don't know what it is, but it never bothered me for some reason. I never even thought about it like twice. And even after the first time I saw it, I'd read those reviews and I was like, it never even crossed my mind. So I think that goes more to the performance from Hamilton than Hudson, but I think both performances are really genuine and really, really exceptional.
And And I especially like the supporting cast in here. They're not people who I really know by face. I mean, I looked up Will Gear later, and I go, oh, okay, he was in the Waltons, he was in this, he was in that. And he plays this, like, Southern gentleman whose name I don't think we ever get, who appears to be the man who owns or runs the company, and he's, like, the biggest advocate for it. And then the other guy being this actor by the name of Jeff Corey, who plays Mr. Ruby, who's sort of the person that Arthur goes to and has to make the deal with. At the corporation, and both of them are just amazing actors. I mean, they really just the scenes are so good, and they play so well, and especially Will Gear's character, where he seems like this just nice and, you know, gentleman who, you know, he's looking out for you, and I understand, and everything, you know, he's sort of the really, really good cop.
So this is what happens to the dreams of youth. Go on, son, let it out. Nothing to be ashamed of. Let it out. It's time for a change. Now look, they'll both be well taken care of. They don't need you and you don't need them. You just can't help each other anymore. Now, look, son, you know what I'm saying is true. There's nothing anymore.
No.
Now what you need now is a good rest. Now, a few things to be worked out in the morning, but my boys will clear those up, and you needn't worry none.
Your boys?
Mm-hmm.
You're the head of it all?
There never was a struggle in the soul of a good man that wasn't hard. My papa told me that. And it's sure enough true. Believe me, son. I know.
The thing, though, that's so telling to me is that he is, I think he's credited as old man, and for somebody who's trying to sell this whole idea of a second life to people, I don't know, unless he went through a second life already, like years and years ago, and he's just about to renew his lease. It's like, dude, you know, it's that whole thing. Like, I liked it so much, I even bought the company kind of thing. It's like, maybe you should, you know, practice what you're preaching here and be a younger version of yourself.
Well, maybe it's like drug dealers, you know, you never use what you sell. Supposedly.
Right.
Right, and I guess it should be mentioned that three of the actors in this film were actually former blacklisted actors, correct? I believe, and I think Will Gear and Jeff Corey were two of the three.
Yeah, that's correct, and you'll hear later when we get into the interview with Stephen Armstrong, he talks a little bit about that and how Frankenheimer had a real soft spot for these guys that he had worked with previously but then couldn't work with because they had been blacklisted.
I don't know if all of us are similar in age. I think me and Mike are. Rob, I'm not so sure, but every time I see the doctor and this Richard Anderson, every time I see Richard Anderson, I immediately think of one thing. Does anybody else think of that same thing?
You're talking Oscar Goldman.
Yes, I am talking Oscar Goldman.
Oh, yeah.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Ooh. So, Mike, we definitely are similar.
We have the technology.
Yes. We can fix him. Yeah.
Yes, he was Steve Austin's handler on the $6 million Man, Rob.
Well, I do remember the $6 million Man, but that was in my high chair and diapers days, so I don't.
Oh, ouch. Yeah. Oh.
A record skip sound effect right there.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the movie's called Seconds. We're talking about second chances here, as well as time ticking by and all this. And this whole idea of second chances for these actors as well. And just the whole idea that we're looking at this, like, you know, once Rock Hudson gets into this community, it's this whole idea of who is a second and who isn't and who works for the company, who's aware, who's not aware, what's going on with this whole thing. So there's that kind of nice thing of, you know, when you look at this group of people where it's like, okay, who's a second, who's not a second, you could kind of look like, you know, who's been on the blacklist, who hasn't, who, you know, is a communist, who's not a communist or a sympathizer or whatever. But then putting Rock Hudson in this role and knowing what we know now, it's this, for me, it's this whole thing of who's a homosexual and who's not a homosexual, and this whole idea of like covering yourself and like trying to be something that you're not and making sure that things don't slip. You know, it's, I don't know if you guys thought about that while you were watching this one or not, but for me, it was this whole other kind of level on top of what I believe Frankenheimer was doing, because I listened to the audio commentary, and at no time did he talk about Hudson's homosexuality at all. But I think for the three of us, when we think Rock Hudson, we probably think, oh yeah, gay actor, just because it was such a big deal when he did come out and they did announce that he had AIDS.
Right.
Well, he was the first big celebrity or, you know, person of note.
Right.
But to get back to the point, I do think that watching this film in retrospect of Rock Hudson's history, it is impossible not to think of the double life that he probably had to live, in Hollywood. Although, from what I understand, most people that really knew him knew he was homosexual. But I guess he was so well-liked that nobody just really leaked that info. So it's very interesting when you look at his past and things like that. But yeah, I mean, even now, I took a note that says, you know, it's interesting that Hudson would be in this role, like maybe for himself and maybe Frankenheimer, you know, maybe he knew and there's like this double life or maybe a second chance or maybe, you know, there's just so much that goes with the psychology of homosexuality in the 60s. And you just have to wonder if some of that's not there. And of course, you know, with the whole, I guess it's like a God of Wine festival or something that takes place where all these hippies get together and start smashing wine and everything else. And you can almost look at that like a baptism scene, like an acceptance of a new life, a totally different life than I'm sure that generation before, you know, the generation that the character comes from originally, the John Randolph character, Arthur Hamilton, would frown upon, honestly, right? Damn hippies.
It's hilarious to go back and watch something like Pillow Talk, which was made in 59, and see how Hudson already then is playing with gay stereotypes and stuff. There's a whole thing where I'm sure you guys know Pillow Talk, where he's talking to Doris Day on a party line, and he is one person to her in person and another person via the party line, and he is casting aspersions upon his other self as he's talking about this and even kind of talking about like, oh, you know, those guys, they're really familiar with their mothers and, you know, this whole kind of thing. And like when he's drinking, his pinky is up and he's talking about getting a recipe from Doris Day and this whole like, you know, oh, you know, is this guy gay or not? Which was kind of weird and a little risque that he was doing this, you know, to himself, you know, years earlier.
Right. Yeah, I am a fan of Pillow Talk, which is not something I admit to often, so there we go.
Hey, I've got the whole Pillow Talk, Lover Come Back, and Send Me No Flowers box set, so I'm right there with you, buddy.
Nice.
Well, you know, obviously we were talking about themes of second chances and things like that. I think that Frankenheimer has a lot in this film of various things that he wants to talk about. I mean, obviously there's sort of this, you know, crisis of the white male, you know, who followed all the rules. You know, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do, but yet my life is boring. And there's also these aspects of dealing with the corporation and what the corporation represents. And sort of one of the things that I thought was interesting about the corporation is they know that they fail. And this is why I said, you know, there are spoilers in this episode, is that they admit at one point that they have a high failure rate, but it just seems that it just keeps perpetuating itself. Like if it was sort of like out in the open that they were failing so much, maybe they would be out of business. And getting them to bring someone else in and then replacing people. And it's sort of this machine operation, this processing operation, which is another thing that I thought that was interesting, is the first two places that he goes before he goes to the building to meet the corporation is first he goes to a dry cleaner and then he goes to a meatpacking facility, which is all about processing. And especially the second one, it's all about cutting meat. So you could say, okay, what is this foreshadowing the surgery? So there's this whole idea of, I guess, maybe process and such. And then the whole aspect of he was following their rules over here as the banker. And then he gets in with the corporation to get a new life. But he's still not free. He has to follow their rules that they've set down as well for the lofty sum of $30,000 in 1965, which, as I looked up, if you were to convert that, it'd be about $600,000 today.
What a bargain.
That'd be the second spot you put a record scratch in right there. You know, the first time I saw this film, I took the Murray Hamilton character like a totally different way, and then I took him this time. And for those of you who don't know, Murray Hamilton is the gentleman that wore the plaid jacket in Jaws. This has the infamous line, you know, "You scream shark," you know, and I'm not going to quote it. I mean, Jesus. I mean, if you don't know that line by now, then you probably have no business listening to any podcast. But the first time I saw it, I thought, well, this guy's just like, you know, he's just out there. This character, this kind of eye of God character that's always kind of talking. And since we're kind of into spoilers, you can kind of speak about that a little bit. It's kind of always, you know, pushing the Hudson character along. But this time watching it, my perception became more, and I don't know if you guys felt this, but it became more almost like a pusher. Like he wants Hudson to fail. So that way he gets his third chance, not so much his second chance. It's what it felt like to me. So I don't know if you guys got that feeling, but that's what it kind of felt like to me.
Yeah, I really got this kind of like Amway feeling while I was watching it. Murray Hamilton is trying to get Rock Hudson involved in it so then he can then move up and get the pin or whatever it is, like those whole tiers of selling when it comes to Amway and all that kind of stuff. But I saw him as kind of being desperate. More than being a pusher, I saw him as being someone who is really trying to get out of a trap that he knows that he's in and that he kind of fell into himself. It just seemed like maybe he wanted, I don't know if he necessarily wanted Rock Hudson's character to fail, but he definitely needed Rock Hudson, or, you know, the John Randolph character. He needed him there so that he could kind of save its own skin, at least for a little while longer, is what it felt like to me.
Well, okay. I also see that the corporation has this thing where they're not just willing to sell it to you. You know, it'd be one thing if he just went in there and said, okay, $30,000, take it or leave it. No, he goes in there and they blackmail him. There's this, they drug him up and then they film him what looks like he's about to rape this woman. And they say, oh, by the way, if you decide not to go along, you know, we can let this out. You know, just you know that that's a possibility. So so you're going to sign now. So there's this added level of insurance on their end that once you pick someone, it's almost a guarantee that they're going to end up going through the process, because there's, within sort of polite society, there's no way that this Arthur Hamilton character would walk out and go, no, I can't do it. Go ahead, release the tape.
You're going to say, so now it's blackmail, eh, Mr. Wilson?
What would you call it?
Just kind of the insurance. Isn't it easier to go forward when you know you can't go back? But you knew that, didn't you? The minute you hung up, Charlie, after that first call. Ah, sure you did.
You're saying I can never go back?
Fact is, you really don't want to go back. Sakes, boy, you owe yourself this thing. Rebirth, life again, begin again, all new, all different, the way you always wanted it. You got another chance. Heck, nobody's going to miss you, are they?
My wife.
What about her? What are you to her now?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's really made very clear in the book. I did read the book of this a few months ago. And I have to say, the movie really follows the book very closely. And the book's not that long. I'd say it's only about like 160 pages. But yeah, it follows it almost beat per beat, really. I think the only thing that's missing is the only thing that was shot and left on the cutting room floor, which was the Rock Hudson visiting his daughter and son-in-law and seeing his grandchild for the first time. So I think that was in the book, and then it was also shot, but then eliminated. So we almost had the chance of having two back-to-back Leonard Nimoy references between Invasion of the Body Snatchers last week and Seconds this week. So we missed that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, because he was cut out of the film.
Yeah.
Also, in a different time, i.e. today, threatening somebody with a videotape of set-up rape, that's probably going to get you a reality show now. You'd probably want him to...
Rock Hudson taking a selfie, doing the duck face. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, he'd have his own show now, and everybody would be on, you know, A&E or the Learning Channel or something, probably. Yeah.
It then gets into a place where you brought up the wine party, the grape party, and I sort of see this also as sort of inverses of themselves, because there's two parties in the film. There's the wine and grape party, and then there's the cocktail party. Yeah. And the wine and grape party is supposed to be, like you were saying, sort of this baptism of the rebirth and things like that. And then you get to the cocktail party, and it's almost like he has to – I'd be willing to bet that if you went to a cocktail party that Arthur Hamilton and his wife were having, it would kind of be like that, although probably not him being as drunk. It would be, you know, a lot of glad handing and how you doing and, you know, real sort of proper stuff. And it's funny that as that goes along and he gets drunker and drunker and starts talking about all this stuff that I guess he's not supposed to talk about, it's all about propriety. People are upset with him because he's stepping over the bounds, or there's a possibility that he's letting out a secret that could not only endanger him, but endanger some of the other people that are at the party.
Resistless, a team sweeps goalward with the fury of the blast. We'll fight for the name of Harvard till the last white line is passed. Truth is, I just stopped feeling loving.
Oh. Zip.
Oh. Wilson.
What?
Oh.
You and I must play golf sometime.
Golf? Golf? Dorcas Wilson playing golf? Huh? Now, Arthur Hamilton.
Looks as if our host is in orbit.
I think that's some of the most fascinating stuff. It's almost like all of us have been to these parties where we wear this, you know, this mask of who we really are, right? We don't, I'm sure all of us have been in some party sometime somewhere where we've been like, well, you know, this isn't who I really am, but I'm just going to go along with this. I might get a job promotion out of this. I might get a deal out of this. You know, I might get something else out of this. And when you're single, you know, you're looking for something out of something, right? So, you know, everybody's been to a party like that. So I really like that second party, because you see the struggle of like this, the cocktail party kind of, you know, the reverence kind of holding back, trying to be social, but also how he can't control it at this point. He's like, you know, he's not only is it just like the sci-fi angle of the corporation and everybody coming down on him and this kind of repression and things like that, but it's like he can't hold that back. He wants that, the wine party, the grape party. That's what he really always wanted, and or maybe that's what he wants now anyway. And he's trying to kind of get that out, but you know, social acceptance won't let him have that. So I really enjoy that scene quite a bit.
It's fascinating to me the part where he is, you know, really trying to relate to everyone, and he keeps mentioning things about his past, only to be corrected. Like, you know, oh, I went to Harvard. It's like, no, you didn't. It's like, oh, well, no, I guess I didn't. You know, this whole like having to backtrack on himself and not being able to relate to people, not being able to kind of share his personal history, and then really he's kind of unable to, you know, use his imagination to kind of make up his own backstory. And it's funny to me, like, that he doesn't really get into this whole idea of this second chance. To me, I don't know about you guys, but like the main character himself, one of the reasons why I guess I don't go back to this movie as often as I do is just because the main character is really kind of not very likable a lot of times. Like as the John Randolph character, that whole scene where he's trying to make love with his wife and he's just so cold and removed, and you can tell that he's kind of already made up his mind that, you know, this is not the life for him. And then when he becomes the Rock Hudson character, he just always seems to be kind of distant from himself and doesn't really, you know, get into it other than that bacchanal. And even then it's like, you know, the woman kind of really pushing him to be part of this, and he finally manages to open up, but then maybe he just kind of goes off the deep end when it comes to the second party and overdoes it. But it's like he doesn't really seem to understand what is expected of him at any point, you know, whether it's as the John Randolph character or as the Rock Hudson character. Both times he seems to be not at ease with the world that he's in.
Well, it just seems that I think one of the themes that is in there is that you can change your appearance or you can change where you live or all these various things, but at the end of the day, you're still in your head. Right. You know, it's still you. And the only way to really change your life would be for you to bring it from the inside out. That all of these things, we can surround you with all this stuff. We can make you look different, give you a brand new, you know, something a lot sexier. But if you're still going to play by the old rules that are in your head, you're never going to move beyond it.
I always imagine when I watch this film, the dark roads that a Paul Verhoeven would take this down.
Going back to Total Recall.
Yeah, the dark roads and how he would have some handsome actor, you know, taking over for the older actor. And then he'd just go all Verhoeven all over the whole thing. He'd just take, you know, similar to what I think he was trying to go for with the Hollow Man. And he just, you know, he swung and he missed.
Oh, yeah, he definitely missed with that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I can see what you're talking about as far as having that ability to do what you want to do and that freedom and everything, and then just embracing it a little too much, holding it a little too tightly. I mean, yeah, the only thing that I remember about the Hollow Man is basically that rape scene. It's just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one of the corollaries also with this in terms of more sort of ancient literature, I won't call it that ancient, but still, is the story of Faust. And how do you sort of see that playing in here?
You mean Faust as being slightly older than the $6 million man?
Yes. You remember when that was written, right? You were hanging around in Germany somewhere in the 1700s?
I definitely do. Yeah, I was reminded a lot of an updated Faustian story, which was the Phantom of the Paradise, that whole idea of Paul Williams kind of making a deal with the devil and having that version of him that never ages. So it kind of reminded me of that when it comes to how this goes, you know, the whole making a deal with the devil idea and just, you know, the devil pretty much setting you up, I guess, going to the samurai's point of Murray Hamilton as kind of that negative force in his life. But also, you know, just they didn't necessarily help him out too much once he became Rock Hudson. It was like the guy that they set him up with, his valet, you know, just like, hey, let's have a party. And it's like, yeah, you might want to let this guy settle in a little bit first.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's aspects of the film that I find interesting, especially with Rock Hudson going back to visit his wife, who obviously doesn't know that she's actually talking to her husband. And I think that's really interesting. And then he comes back and goes, basically, you know, I don't want this anymore. I think it almost sounds to me this level of regret where he's like, you know, maybe if I go back to my real life, my original life, knowing what I know now and seeing it from a different angle, I could make it better. I could do things better. And I thought of this, there's this T.S. Eliot poem. It says, "We shall not cease the exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." So the idea that you can look all over the place, but eventually you're going to end up right back where you started, and you'll look at it from a different angle, and you can gain knowledge from that. So coming back home, quote unquote, is not necessarily a bad thing.
I really like that scene, too. There's a slight bit of, like, it could be even creepier. Like, he could have made that scene much more creepier. And again, I guess that kind of goes to, if somebody was to remake that in kind of our modern time, how much, you know, how far would they take it? But I like that, you know, it almost turns into a fable at that point. The grass is always greener, you know what I mean? So I really like that little aspect of the film. And this is where this scene and some of the other stuff is where I think you see that Rock Hudson was a good actor. He wasn't just another face. I think he was. I'm not going to say he was a great actor, but I think he was a very serviceable actor.
Yeah, having seen him in some of the Douglas Sirk stuff, I definitely have respected him as an actor. And you're right, seeing him, that particular scene with the wife is really where the rubber meets the road in this one. It is where you see the heartache and regret that goes by. And when he goes out to his servant, who I always wonder, like, so was this a second that didn't work out? You know, is this another guy who, you know, rather than kind of being grist for the mill like Hudson's about to be, or, you know, did he just end up like, hey, you know, it didn't really work out with you being a second, so you're going to be some other guy's valet. Next one that we get, here you go. You know, I don't know. What do you guys think about that one?
Well, I also think that there are probably people within the corporation, such as the gentleman, I can't remember his name off top of my head, the Asian actor. He was also in Manchurian Candidate, and then Nora Marcus character in here, and maybe the valet, that these are just people who are hired. And I was thinking about it as, you know, they get something from the corporation. I don't necessarily think they may be seconds themselves, but it's more sort of the staged managed life kind of thing, which I was thinking, I go, kind of like Truman Show, you know, once he becomes a second, you don't necessarily know what's reality, and you don't necessarily know who's been put in your path in order to play up this aspect of what your new life's supposed to be.
I like that angle, though. I like that angle, Mike, that maybe it's a failed second, although I would think as a corporation, though, that would just set you up for fail to put more of your failures in the field like that to help the one succeed. It just seems like, you know, that possibly that would be the Stallone role and we get a revenge movie out of it.
But you're really casting the remake, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, you know.
I love it.
So speaking of which, has there been talk of remakes on this one?
I haven't heard of any.
You know,
thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. But not only will I say that, but I still would argue that this film, even though it just recently it's kind of been in the zeitgeist again because it got a Blu-ray release from Criterion, and it's been released, you know, it was on VHS, and I think it was released, I know it was released on DVD because I think there's a Frankenheimer commentary on there as well. Even now with it just getting re-released, people still don't talk about it. It's one of those films that I'll just never understand. It exists in this kind of purgatory. And it's one of these films that even to this day, you'll say, hey, you know, have you seen Seconds? And I'd say 9 out of 10 people I meet have not seen Seconds. It's one of those films.
It's almost like an exclusive club.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, it's funny that you say that because the person who we have on this week, Professor Stephen Armstrong, feels that way about John Frankenheimer, too, that he's kind of an exclusive club, sadly.
Yeah, I remember Frankenheimer really kind of, you know, Samurai, you gave some good examples of some of his work. The one that always got me was The Manchurian Candidate, and the way that kind of got pulled out of release, at least that was a story I heard when it was kind of getting its second life, back, oh God, that must have been late 80s or something when it started to kind of come back to the fore and like, oh, hey, what about this Manchurian Candidate film? And isn't this kind of creepy the way that it paralleled, Kennedy assassination, da, 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 da. But it's like, that one kind of disappeared and Seconds seem to have disappeared. It's just like, you know, what was going on with Frankenheimer's career that all of his movies were just like, suddenly go away. You know, I don't know if there was a, you know, if we can look at it as conspiracy, which is always fun, but, or if it was just like really bad luck on his part.
Yeah. He had ups and downs like a lot of directors do, but arguably his run of Birdman, Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, The Train and Seconds, 5 films in a row, is as good as anybody's run of 5 films in a row. So I would argue that point. And of course he has little bits and pieces in between. 52 Pickup, which is totally underrated, and another movie that people just don't see. Of course, most people nowadays know him as the director of like Dr. Moreau and Reindeer Games and the things that he doesn't need to be remembered for, even though he did do Ronin in there somewhere in between. But yeah, I mean, he's an odd director as far as history has treated him. It does feel like the people who adore him will really push him on people. And yet again, people do not go pursuing Frankenheimer films. And of course, you know, when I remember reading the article, I don't know if you guys know this, I'm pretty sure you probably do, it got around quite a bit that, you know, when Michael Bay was trying to discover who his father was, and this whole thing came up that, you know, Frankenheimer was dating his mother for an extended amount of time, and there was supposedly this blood test done, and Frankenheimer denied it, but nobody would say anything, but Michael Bay is absolutely convinced that John Frankenheimer was his son, and or his dad. Now, whoa, got a little weird there. And it's so bizarre to me that, you know, this guy, you know, even then he could have maybe capitalized on maybe getting a little coin by being Michael Bay's dad, and he still didn't do it. So I don't know. Maybe he was difficult to work with. I don't know.
From the producer of Michael Bay. No, really.
Ouch. I don't know if I'd want to admit it.
No, I wouldn't either. After Pain and Gain, maybe, but after Transformers 1, 2, and 3, probably not.
That might be your third opportunity for a record scratch. Third time's a charm, man.
All right, we're going to take a break and play an interview with the author of two books about director John Frankenheimer, Professor Stephen Armstrong.
GGTMC, live for you, fresh air. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Life is so busy. From my job to my family and all the things in between, sometimes you need to make a little time for yourself. And I found something nice to make those times oh so sweet. It's Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, men, and couples. And if you're new to all this, they have plenty of helpful suggestions and information to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has taken your privacy seriously. Go to the site and read all about it. And right now, when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order from Vibrators.com's huge catalog. That's Vibrators.com. Do something nice for you.
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
What's that other option? BBNBC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Ooh, wait, get back here. Hey, get back here.
John Frankenheimer, sort of, where did your interest start with him?
My interest began, about 18 years old, I was a student at the University of Maryland, and that was when around the time that the New York Film Festival had resuscitated the Manchurian Candidate, and the film was re-released, and people started saying, you know, whatever happened to John Frankenheimer? And I, as a student, was able to see the film on videotape in a film class, and I just was really bowled over by it. And then, you know, years passed, and I became very, very interested in film noir, and had done some writing about, and you know, looking at Orson Welles films and Billy Wilder and you know, that whole movement. And you know, that there are these books, these encyclopedias about film noir, and with Alan Silver and James Rossini, and they listed not only The Manchurian Candidate as an example of film noir, but also French Connection 2 and 52 Pickup. 52 Pickup is an adaptation of an Elmore Leonard novel, but instead of being set in Detroit, it's set in L.A. Anyway, I saw this movie, French Connection 2, and I've always had sort of a sneering attitude towards sequels in most cases, except for, of course, Godfather Part 2 and Superman Part 2, which I really enjoyed. And so I found a videotape copy of French Connection 2, and I was just bowled over by its excellence and its darkness. And in that film, it's a reversal of the Friedkin version, where you have the Frenchman in New York. Now you have the American in Marseille. And, you know, I'm watching French Connection 2, and I'm thinking, my God, why is Frankenheimer not a bigger name? And this was about 15 years after I'd been so moved by The Manchurian Candidate. And, you know, so I started looking at other films that Frankenheimer had done, not the ones that are so well known, 7 Days in May and Grand Prix, Seconds, but the weirdo ones, the obscure ones that he'd done later on, and one of them being 52 Pickup, this other film noir. And that is a great understated crime film. And that actually Roy Scheider appears in it. If Gene Hackman was in French Connection 2, Roy Scheider, the other star in French Connection, was in 52 Pickup. And, you know, I would qualify myself as an interested viewer of these films, but not necessarily a connoisseur, even an admirer. But then Frankenheimer died. And again, what happened is that in the news cycle, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, even People Magazine and Entertainment Weekly were talking about how here you had one of these major directors of the 1960s who sort of sputtered in the decades afterwards. Of course, this wasn't true. He'd won several Emmys in his last decade at work. He was a second rising director with, you know, films with De Niro and Ben Affleck. And so, you know, I remember when Kurt Cobain died, there was this huge appetite of interest again in Nirvana. And I thought, well, maybe that's going to happen with Frankenheimer. And I was I ran into a publisher in Cleveland, and Frankenheimer had just died. And I said, I think there might be interest in a book about him. And they said, sure, send us the proposal. And I did it, and I got a contract, and I just went to work. And, you know, he did about 35 pictures, numerous commercials, TV work, a film for the internet for BMW. And, you know, I assembled them. I put together a huge collection of photo stills. And that was the book that I turned out. It was called Pictures About Extremes, the Films of John Frankenheimer. And the term Pictures About Extremes is from an interview that he'd given when he was talking actually about a movie that he made called The Fourth War, with Roy Scheider, about men, primarily male characters, who are pushed themselves into situations of great crisis. And that's what interested him. And I thought, well, you know, that's a good label to hang on this book. And it was definitely a tourist in its outlook, always looking for these stylistic and thematic tendencies that appear over and over and over again. And the real thrust of the book was to attack the notion that Frankenheimer's great period was in the 1960s and that something happened after Seconds. Instead, a great deal of excellence can be found in those subsequent films. Black Sunday, French Connection 2, 52 Pickup, Against the Wall, the TV movie he made for HBO. The second book, you know, I'd become quite knowledgeable about Frankenheimer's interviews. And, you know, the University of Mississippi Press has all those nice books out, Fred Zinnemann, Fritz Lang, Billy Wilder. And I thought I would do something like that on Frankenheimer. And I pitched it to a group called Scarecrow Press because they had done a book. Harry Carey Jr., the John Ford actor, had done his autobiography with this outfit called Scarecrow Press. And I liked that. So I sent them a query and a proposal. And they said, sure, go for it. And I assembled about, I don't know, 25 interviews with Frankenheimer, a number of magazine profiles. And also, over the years, I had interviewed people who'd worked with Frankenheimer, the novelist Pete Hamill, the actor Tim Reed, the cinematographer John Leonetti. And I included those as well, along with an interview with Evans Frankenheimer, the director's widow. I didn't conduct that actually, but I was given permission to include it. And I've done some writing about Frankenheimer on the side. I just did a piece on Seconds, and I've done something on French Connection too over the years. And I think I mentioned in an email I was sort of an informal consultant on the new Criterion release of Seconds.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more as far as your research on Seconds. What did you find out about it, and what's kind of your angle when it comes to writing about the film?
Seconds had its run back in 1966. It was screened at Cannes, see Booze. The only applause that it got was when Rock Hudson showed up before the movie started and raised his hand. He was the rest of the film was booed, was condemned for its darkness, its strangeness, what have you. And Paramount, the group that initially released it, did not have any faith. And so when it came out, I guess it was in the late summer of that year, there was little advertising, little efforts to book it with the exhibitors. And the film, though it got some good reviews, largely vanished. And it really marked the end of Rock Hudson's turn as a somewhat provocative actor, I think, because he'd done some interesting work with Bob Aldrich and Douglas Sirk in the decade before. And after Seconds, he just, you know, pretty much went into TV and a couple of B-Westerns, or not B-Westerns, but second-string Westerns. And Seconds went the way, in many ways, of the Manchurian Candidate, in that it had a kind of a cult following, but it sank, and it would play in the repertory houses in L.A. and New York, and it had some attention in Europe. And, you know, in the 1990s, when I think there was this new interest blooming about Frankenheimer's 60s work, Paramount got behind it, found a copy of the film, and released it on home video. And one thing that's an important detail is that, if you're familiar with the movie, it starts out very much focused on John Randolph and then Rock Hudson. And at the end, it's very much focused on Rock Hudson, his travails, his anguish. But in the middle, there's this strange love story with Salome Jens. And she's a beautiful sort of European lover who turns out to be an employee of the company that performs these operations on the clients that give them the new identities. And Salome Jens and Rock Hudson go on a date to a wine festival in the Santa Barbara area in the hills up there. And when the film was originally put together in, I guess, late 65, the Legion of Decency, the Catholic operation, looked at this grape-crushing scene. You had naked people jumping up and down on grapes, and they said, cannot have that. And large parts of that grape scene, the wine vat scene, were cut out. And Frankenheimer thought, well, you know, it not only did that spoil the scene, but it also made it look more like an orgy than it ever had previously. And so the film was shortened in that sense. But in 95, when Paramount decided to release it on videotape, those lost minutes were restored. And, you know, about 5 years later, Frankenheimer did a director's commentary when it was decided to release that version, the expanded director's cut, if you will, version of the film on DVD. And each time you had these releases come out, there was a lot of attention and a lot of storytelling, a lot of coverage, and the perception that here was a
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.